Om Shanti and good morning. When we say something is good luck, or we say something is bad luck, what does it really mean? Does it mean that there is somebody up there who is giving blessings and someone else around who's cursing? Well, not quite like that. Yes, we do get blessings from above, but in this case, when something good happens and I wasn't expecting it, it is good fortune, it is good luck, but it's also part of the drama. I came down onto this planet, took on many, many different costumes, and at different times through the Copper Age and the Iron Age, I did maybe some good deeds. I don't know when and what, but I see the result of that coming through, and I call it good luck. But equally, the other way happens, that sometimes there are things that I don't like that are happening, and I say, well, it's just my luck. But in fact, nothing happens without a reason. There's a law which is absolutely inflexible, and it's the law of cause and effect. And so both go together. I'm seeing the effect, but there was a cause that I was involved with at some point. You know, when there's a big storm and our dear friends in the meteorological department haven't told us about it, we say, what happened? What happened? In past centuries, they would have said, oh, it was the devils cursing us. And if there was something good, they'd have said, it's the gods blessing us. But in fact, today we know that if there's a sudden storm, there were things that were happening maybe thousands of miles away, and that led to a whole sequence of events that resulted in the storm. And so nothing happens without cause. And when we get caught up in the effect, then we react. But no, it's all part of the drama, and my karma is part of the drama also. So sometimes we say, well, it's drama that it's happened. But you could equally say, well, it's my karma that it happened. And so, looking at the situation of the world today, we're all part of the same story. And so all of us together, collectively, have made it happen to the point where now there's total breakdown and chaos. But there's also then the opportunity to do good karma. Sometimes people take the word karma as being always not good. But in fact, the word karma is neutral. Good, bad, neutral, whatever. And so what's happening in this period, if you recall some of the things from yesterday, this period is described as the Diamond Age, the age of transformation, the best age to actually be in, even though it seems so crazy outside, but it actually is the best time to be around, because this is the time when we can have a direct connection with the Divine. Golden Age, Silver Age, we're happy, we're content. The children are out at play and the parents can relax in their home. And it's a little bit like that. Up above, in a home of nirvana, the place beyond sound, place of silence, our parent is relaxing. Doesn't have to think about the children. The children are happy and content and playing wonderfully with each other. Everything's absolutely in tune, in harmony. But that's the result of all the good karma that we did with God's guidance, God's power, God's love and support. that we actually did the good karma, and that created the golden age and the silver age. But it's like having capital in the bank, and if you draw from the capital, at some point it's going to run out. And so in another analogy, yesterday we spoke about the energy and the power of purity gradually reaching a critical point and it flips around. But in fact, with this idea of capital, we draw on it, we experience the joy, the power, the love, the beauty, and it runs out. And so the story of Adam and Eve, banishment from the garden where they had to not toil or labor. And then they were told, once you're out, then you're going to have to work hard for your own living. And so basically then, from that moment on, the Copper Age, not just Pandora's box opening up, but also karma kicking in a big way. And so then, whatever it is I do, whether in one birth or afterbirths, I have to see what the result is. I'm either putting in more credit through good karma, but usually not so much credit. Usually, maybe it's just mundane karma for my livelihood, but it's sweat and toil. And then maybe it's very bad karma, and so that debt is accumulated. And by the time we come to the end of the Iron Age, our shoulders start drooping. We're carrying a big burden of many births. And yes, from time to time, our good karma has brought us beautiful results, and we enjoy that. But there's also a lot of other things going on. Sometimes we don't even realize what is good karma and what is bad karma. And you had a lesson on that already, so I won't go into that further. But the beauty of this period is that every good karma that I do gets enhanced because I'm doing it with love for God, with a direct connection with the divine, which I wasn't doing Copper Age, Iron Age. I was struggling, I was looking, and maybe I thought I had found God, but maybe I didn't. But it was a struggle throughout. But this moment, we have the joy of knowing the divine, experiencing the relationship, many relationships with the divine, but most of all, just simply doing even a little action with love in my heart for the divine, without any other motive or selfishness involved. And one good karma yields 100-fold fruit. And so within one lifetime, or even a very small part of one lifetime, I can do so much good karma that I accumulate for several thousands of years. I won't go into the detail of the numbers, how many thousands of years and how many births, etc. No need, because the main thing to understand is that there is a cycle, and the cycle is actually about my karma. What I do today, how I create my future fortune, what I do through the Copper Age and Iron Age, and then how I come back to the point where all fortune opens up for me once again. And so the beginning is not actually the Golden Age. The beginning is right now. And the beauty of this, I can understand and see the whole drama. Golden Age, Silver Age, I just enjoy. I don't think too much about the future. They talk about how it's important to be in the present. Well, the deities, the divine beings, all of us in our divine form, we are absolutely in the present. We don't remember the past, we don't have to think about it, we don't have to be concerned about the future, it's okay. But now, the third eye of wisdom having opened up, it's not a physical eye. Do you feel you've been through some surgery here? I think you have. I think there's been some surgery happening here to open up your third eye so that you see yourself, you see the divine, and you see the entire cycle of time, the whole of the drama. And our relationship now is with the director of the drama. This is the time when God gives us directions and tells us what the whole drama is about and actually offers us total choice about what it is we would like to do in the future. What sort of role would you like to have? It's totally open. And according to my understanding of spiritual laws, according to my application of those spiritual laws, and then the power I get from God, I create my future fortune. So maybe some of you used to think like I used to think when I was little, that, you know, it's a very boring time to be around. It's not so exciting like it was in some period in history. But in fact, I was wrong. And as I began to understand spirituality, I realized that this is actually the most dramatic time. It's the most beautiful time, the most exciting time to be aware. And so look at the whole cycle. And the director tells us the entire story, beginning, middle, and end. And the interesting thing is that it's not just one aspect of eternity. There are three aspects of eternity. God, the divine, the supreme, by whatever name we choose to call that being. God is eternal. Nobody made him. There was no date at which God didn't exist and someone made her. No, God exists, full stop. Soul. Soul also eternal. But the third thing that's also eternal is this earth, this planet itself, and all that is within it, nature, environment, everything. Which is very interesting because whatever it is we've done to nature, we don't have to worry. Yes, we're very aware of reducing our carbon footprint, but I don't need to become anxious. There's some people, there's a term out there that some of you might be aware of, and it's called climate anxiety. And a lot of people are very worried. They're not doing anything to change their lifestyle. They're just worrying about it. You know how some people worry about their health, but they're supposed to go for a walk, or they're supposed to exercise, or they're supposed to change their diet. They don't do that. They just worry. And so climate anxiety is a little bit like that. People just worry about what's going to happen. But there are steps they could take to make things different, and they don't do that. But in fact, we don't have to save nature. Nature is eternal. It's going to go through its process of, you know how sometimes there is a wildfire, and I'm not talking about the situation where there's so much suffering in habitats at the moment, but within nature there's a system that the tribal people know about, whether it's India or South America or Australia, wherever. Things happen with seasons, and the fire comes and the fire cleanses and there's a fresh beginning. and seeds that were there could only open because of the fire. And so the seeds are opened up and the fresh beginning happens. So nature goes through its cleansing and creates the golden age for us, where there's beauty and everything is clean and pure and pristine, and we have the new beginning again. So at this moment, understanding God eternal, soul eternal, nature eternal also. So not so much a story of 7 days of creation, but creation itself also actually eternal. And the whole game of the drama is a game of all these three together. A time of harmony, a time of exploitation, a time of upheaval, chaos, and again coming back to the state of harmony. And so the director is the one who knows all the details of the story. And if I follow his directions today, what that means is that I'm now in tune with what's happening within the drama. So often we think this isn't right, it shouldn't be like this. And yet, in fact, drama is absolutely precise. Everything happens in the right way, at the right time. And if my mind is screaming and saying, no, it shouldn't be like this, I'm out of touch with the drama. And I'm causing myself a lot of pain. If I pause for a moment and become an observer, not just the actor within the drama, but the observer of my own role within the drama, then I have a deeper understanding of what the drama is about, how to understand that, but also what input I can have at this moment. So my role of the drama becomes clear to me only when I step back and start observing the drama. While I'm just simply engaged in it, well, I'm enjoying it maybe, or maybe I'm not enjoying it, but I don't have the capacity to be able to do anything about it. Stepping back means I understand the drama. I also understand the role of others within the drama. And so through that awareness, the quality of my interaction is going to be one in which I make sure that I'm not adding further to my karmic debt or bondage, but I'm able to take steps to be able to settle that account. Simple example, somebody is getting very angry and I can't change my situation. I can't take steps to get out of it. Maybe there's even anger to the point of violence. But when I start understanding the drama and I realize that there's some debt to settle, but I can go beyond. I can take power and learn to respond in a different way to the anger that's coming to me. I know it raises many questions, and that's a very simplistic way to put it, but it gives you some idea. And I'm not talking about domestic violence, where there's a huge amount of other karmic situations that come in, but a simple thing. My boss is an angry person, and I get upset by it. Well, I have a choice. Do I stay in the job? And if I do, am I going to carry on getting unhappy? Or am I going to be able to take a distance and say, well, that's the way this person is, he or she, and I'm not going to let it bother me. I'm going to play my role as I should and not be upset by this. So the change of awareness and the power I get through this transformation, both from the divine as well as my new perspective, means that I can deal with things probably with a laugh, with a smile. So next time your boss gets angry, try smiling. And maybe it doesn't work first time. Maybe there'll be more anger. But if it keeps happening, the other person begins to look at things differently. And they'll probably say to you, well, I am not happy about this, but you'll just laugh about it, won't you? So there are different ways to deal with things. But the important thing is, in any situation, just go in here. I, the soul, and I can choose what option I have and respond, not just react. But if I respond, that is my responsibility, then I'm settling karma. I'm not adding to my karma. Every time I react, I'm adding fuel, I'm adding more to my karmic debt. So the concept of drama isn't just a philosophical approach. It is a reality. My home is there and I'm here to play a part. And so I can decide what sort of part I choose to play. But it's also time to go home. The drama is coming to its conclusion and we will all go home together, and then each one according to their own capacity will come and join this world cycle drama according to whatever karma is the karma they have done. So in, I hope, a simple way, but I hope a way that's practical, you'll start looking at what's going on in the world with the third eye rather than just these two eyes. These two eyes make everything very partial. I'm partial to this or I'm partial to this. But with the third eye open, I don't need to take sides. A very important thing in today's world, because we don't know what is under the surface. We don't know what is the intricacy of the story behind the scene. And so I can't make a statement most times wrong, right. There's too much other stuff involved. So nothing is right, as it should be. But also equally, what seems to be wrong, there might be other factors there. And so to be the observer, to have that inner awareness of clarity, so that I see things from here, from the aspect of awareness of the soul, a spiritual awareness, and things are very different. There might be more questions created than answers at this moment. Just to add to the beautiful web, the embroidery that's being explained at the moment. The embroidery outside, the tapestry is beautiful. And backside, you see all the different colored threads that made up the picture. But on first sight, you don't see all the threads. You just see the picture. And so the drama, amazing story. But understanding all the threads takes a lot of time. And then sometimes the picture is very different, not as pretty as one would have thought. But in a simple way, the understanding of drama can make a huge difference to my life. It gives me stability. It gives me detachment. It gives me the ability to deal with things in an appropriate manner. But I know that there was one particular story that didn't happen at a particular time, and so I requested that I take up this time now to explain a little bit about that story. And that's the story of Brahma Baba and how this man became Brahma Baba. On one level, a man who had everything, the world at his feet. He was born in a simple family, but he wasn't so much interested in scholarly achievement. And so at a very early age, about 15, he decided to go. His father was a school teacher, so the natural thing would have been to study. But his inclination took him out into the world. He became a salesman for a grain merchant, became a grain merchant himself, and through various things, finally became a diamond merchant. And in those days, you didn't have expensive instruments to gauge the quality of stones. But he had a brilliant eye, and he was able to see the value of stones and judge them and then find the best stones and use them for a beautiful creative jewelry. And so he became known to the princes of India at that time, and they would say to him, Lakhiraj Babu, his name was Lakhiraj, God made a mistake. He should have made you a king instead of me. And he would smile and say, God doesn't make mistakes. But his royalty, his honesty, his dignity, his generosity, all of this made them use expressions like this. So he was used to working with the kings. They gave him permission to come into the queen's and princess's quarters to show the jewelry so that they themselves could pick it, instead of sending somebody there to the shop to pick up stuff, bring it here, take it back, which was the usual custom. But they trusted him totally. He was dealing with the viceroys of the day. So in terms of wealth, there was abundance. In terms of character, very high morals. In terms of religion, he had a series of 12 gurus learning, and the guru would then say, yes, you can take another step, go to another guru. And so a series of 12 gurus, very unusual. He would be engaged in spiritual discipline and practice from very early in the morning through till about 10 o'clock. And then personal activity and being with the family, and then only going to work around 12, 1, and coming back home by 4. So in a short few hours, this is towards the final period of his working life, in a short few hours, the deals he would strike would be no need for written contracts. Your word was your bond, and that was it. And the day's work would be done. But such generosity of heart and such compassion that even the devotion he was engaged in, he would say, this is for the family, this is for the world, and this is for myself. So that awareness of serving the world. And at one point, a young man working in his shop, and a packet, a little envelope of jewels went missing. And asking around, nobody else had come into the shop, and the vision fell on this young man. And so he called this young man across, and he said, everything okay at home? And the young man burst into tears. His mother was very seriously unwell, and he didn't have the money to take care of her. and he'd been very worried, and he'd picked up the packet and taken it to help the mother. So what Dada, he was called Dada or Babu at that time. So Dada gave him a lot of love, didn't scold him, didn't tell him off, and just simply said, "Okay, you give me back that packet and I'll give you the money and you don't have to think about returning it. But in future, if you need something, just come and talk about it and ask me." So from this is just one little story, but many stories that I heard personally from, he wouldn't tell us those stories. His daughter-in-law, who was also surrendered, she told us these stories. And his daughter, who the daughter looked, and she was part of this also, the daughter looked literally her father's daughter. And so just seeing her, we'd be reminded. And the daughter-in-law told us how by the time it was about 1932, around that time, he spent a lot of time in solitude. Normally he was a very sociable person, but more and more in silence, time alone. And long story short, but by 1936, he'd had a series of visions. One was a vision of God as a being of light, which is different to what his traditional understanding had been. Another vision of the image of the four-armed figure, which is called Vishnu, the symbol of man and woman together, the perfect being. And he heard the words, "Tattvam asmi," you are this, you are he. Didn't understand. And then he had this third vision, and it was over a period of weeks. And the third vision was of the modern world going into upheaval and souls returning home, and then the stars coming down in the way that I described yesterday, and the start of the golden age. And it took him a long time to understand how he could be the instrument to make this happen. He'd heard this word, these words, when he had this vision. You have to create such a world. And no understanding. And he'd gone to his gurus in that space of time to find out what all this meant. And from the blank look in their eyes, he knew that they couldn't tell him. And so he'd gone into, by the end of the third vision, he went off into the mountains, the Himalayas, to reflect deeply about all these things. And gradually things became clear that what was needed was spiritual education. Also it became clear that humans themselves were those highest beings who later on we thought we had to worship, but those beings were human, but with divine qualities. And when he came back, he started sharing these ideas. And the strange thing was, he'd look at somebody and they would go off into a trance and have visions. Some would have visions of light, some would have visions of that image of Vishnu, some would have visions of Krishna, and people thought, this is a hypnotist, this is a magician, what's going on? And a lot of opposition also started at the same time. But people who understood and experienced, they came to him wanting more knowledge. And it became so chaotic with powerful followers and others who weren't wanting all this. And so he left to go to Karachi. This was in Hyderabad, Sindh, now Pakistan. But it was the one India at that time. And so he went off to Karachi. And he took his family with him. He He'd been working in Calcutta and Bombay, but now home was firstly Hyderabad and now Karachi. And the family had understood these changes that were happening, and it was their choice to be with him. And so many people came and gathered around him. Nobody told them where to go. They turned up at his doorstep, and very quickly houses were arranged, 7 houses, and I've seen, I think, about 3 of them. Some of them might have been demolished, some we couldn't find, but about 3 of them I've seen. And so a sister's home, a mother's home, a brother's home, and so on. And they started a period of intense meditation, which actually then lasted 13 years. And it was a majority Muslim neighborhood. Totally Sindh was majority Muslim, and is of course now. But in that, the Muslims saw them as Allah Lok, people of God. And so they supported and helped in every way possible. Even in terms of court cases, some were dismissed because women had come, but they had the right of choice, freedom of choice. Women's rights actually started in Karachi in the 40s. I don't think that's a part of history that's recorded, but a British judge at that time made the decision that women had the right to choose a life of celibacy if this is what they wanted in their pursuit of God. So that was a historical judgment. Things quietened down and they continued with their intense meditation. And by the time the partition happened, their families were asking them to join them to come to India. And the guidance that was coming through Brahma Baba was that stay, no need for any panic, just stay. And when it's time to go, the signal will be given. And 1950, the signal was given to move. And the move happened with the support of the authorities, the Muslim authorities, which again, very unusual, but everything happened very, very smoothly. And so they came by ship from Karachi to a harbour in Gujarat, Oka, and then by train to Abu. A friend, a Swami, had given information that Abu is a place to go to, far from the eyes of the world, and a place where the summer palaces of the kings were, and so they could all stay under one roof. And so May 5th, 1950, they came to India, to Abu. And we've been in Abu ever since. Abu has changed from a little tiny village to a little town, and now it's become a big, overcrowded town. But 1950 when they came, it was after the war, and things were not so easy for anyone. But the love, the joy of their yoga, that carried them through that whole period. 91, 92, they were responding to invitations for their families to go to these different places and start centers. And so little activities started. And 1954, they were invited to a conference in Japan, and a group went off there to share these ideas, not just in Japan, but all over the East. And my mother came into contact, and my grandmother, when a center started in Pune, where we were living at the time. And my parents came as refugees during the major upheaval. And it's interesting that they never shared any stories of horror or tragedy. they would tell stories about their childhood days when everybody would play together and it was no problem. But they didn't share any stories of horror. I think they themselves had wanted to erase those from their own memory, and certainly they didn't want any trauma to be passed on. So 1957, my parents, my grandmother, my mother came through Dadi Janki to Raj Yoga, and a few months later we came abroad. But again, we met this man, Brahma Baba, in Delhi, and I was 8, and Brahma Baba was a grandfather, a very loving, very charming, very powerful. Baba was more than 6 feet tall, unusual for Indian men at that time. Things a bit different today, but very unusual at that time. So just his presence, his physical presence was incredible. But of course his spiritual power was even more incredible. And I also had the good fortune of meeting Mama, the spiritual mother at that time. And she was the embodiment of love. But Brahma Baba also, wonderful charisma and shining, light shining through him all the time. But just a little story of the compassion of this person. We came to live in London at that time, my parents, my brother and myself. My father was starting a business there. 2 years later, my father was just getting established. And 2 years later, a postman brings a parcel. And we open it, and there's 6 mangoes. And Baba's been in Bombay eating the Alfonso mangoes, which are called the king of mangoes even now. And as he was eating mango, he remembered 2 little children 5,000 miles away and asked one of the brothers to get mangoes and send them by airmail post. Now, it wasn't a time when supermarkets had fruits and vegetables going across from one continent to another. It didn't happen like that. And I had lots of relatives in India, but they didn't think about the kiddies out there. They carried on with their own life, which is fine. But how did he suddenly remember these 2 children out there? He had enough to do, many things to work on, sort out. But his memory and his love. And so, of course, it leaves an indelible print in your heart when something like that happens. So the connection with Abu was very strong. And when we came back to India, again, we'd meet him. But it was like 2 different lives. Coming to Abu was like being in paradise. Everything was very simple, so there was nothing. There was not a single chair in the classroom, not even in the dining room. People sat on the floor. Even Brahma Baba didn't have a chair. He had a little stool, and we called it the gaddi. And he would sit on that, back straight, even till the very end, 93. And everything very simple. But the beauty, the joy, the love was tangible, absolutely tangible. To the point where when after a few days in Abu, we'd leave to go back home, there would be tears. I didn't want to leave. But when I'd get back home, that was a different world. And that was my dream. And so Abu was a dream, but life was London, and that was real. And I never bothered to understand anything more until when I'd started university. And I realized I had so many choices in front of me. And I didn't have the wisdom with which to make my choice. which is actually the formula for stress. Too much choice and not enough wisdom. So I didn't know which direction I wanted to go in. So study was fine, but come November, December, a conversation with my father and the decision that if I wanted to get to know my own roots, I should spend time in India. So I came to India and first just a social butterfly and tourist, which was fine for a few months, but then your head begins to feel a bit woolly. And so I thought, what can India offer that I can't get in London? And I went to Dadi Janki, knocking on her door, literally. And she knew me and was happy to see me. And she started talking about, well, she asked, do you want to say something or shall I share? I said, come to listen to you. And she started to share about conscience and how the conscience at this moment is so influenced by society, by media, by friends, education. And so all these layers on the conscience mean that we're not able to see what is real, what is not real. And I said, well, how do you get rid of these influences? And she said, you have to learn to meditate. And so that same evening, I came back to start the course. And within a couple of days, she said, well, you're used to hearing Brahma Baba in Madhuban, and so come early morning to hear the lessons. We call them the Muralis, the magic flute, the music that can change your awareness and make you fly. So I had started going to classes morning and evening. And within 6 weeks, I decided this is to be my life. And I told Daddy, and Daddy said, write to Baba. I wrote to Baba. This is by then May 1968. And the reply from Baba came by telegram the next day. And Baba didn't let the grass grow under his feet. If there was something he wanted to do, it had to be now. So a telegram came inviting me to come to Abu with Daddy. She was anyway planning to go, so that we could have a chat personally. And meeting Baba then came 2 weeks later to Abu June, and he said, but I knew it already. And I remembered that 3 years earlier he had said that I would be a spiritual teacher, and my Hindi was so raw that I didn't understand what he was saying. I thought it was just nice words to humor me. But he'd actually used the word adhyatmik shikshak, spiritual teacher, a ruhani shikshak, spiritual. So he then gave me very clear guidance about what I needed to do. And he continued to give me that guidance through letters, step by step by step. And then in December, I came to see him again, this time as one of the teachers with a whole group. And I didn't realize that I was seeing him for the last time in the physical form. And then January the 18th, 1969, he flew away. And he was then 93. And it's strange how, although his age was already so advanced, nobody'd had the thought that he would just leave. But 700 people gathered in Abu at that time. The instruction that had come through the trans messenger was, don't do anything quickly, wait. A lot of people are going to want to come. And again, very unusual within India that you don't do a cremation instantly. And if somebody leaves at night, like Brahma Baba, next morning he would definitely do the ceremonies and have the cremation immediately. But the instruction came, wait. And so I arrived in Abu Monday morning. I'd been in India, I was fortunate. So I came and so I was part of all the ceremonies. But another very unusual thing, and that was that the message came that it would be Dadi Prakash Muni who would be the first person to light the funeral pyre. We had little sandalwood sticks and you could burn those. Sometimes women don't even attend cremations. It's considered that they wouldn't be able to emotionally tolerate it. But certainly you never have a woman light a fire, the funeral fire. If you don't have a son, you would find a nephew or a brother or some male member within the extended family. But the instruction came that Dadi Prakash Muni should light the fire. His son, blood connection son, had come. The person who was his spiritual son, a very powerful individual, Jagdish Bhai, he was there. But it was this young woman. She was, on one level, not very young. She was in her 40s, but on another level, very young. So she was in her 40s. She was asked to light the fire. But it set the scene for the future, because then the guidance came again that two women, Dadi Prakash Muni and an older woman, Didi Manmohini, would be the leaders who would take care of all the members of the family. Very long story, cut very short, but the decisions that we were told about, the instructions we were given at that time, when the after the cremation and the first ceremonies of offering food were happening. The instructions that we were given at that time, 21st January 1969, set the pattern for everything that's happened since, and they still hold good today. And Dadi Prakash Muni, together with Didi, and Didi passed away in 83, but Dadi Prakash Muni continued to be the leader of the organization, together with another group of the dadis, the elders, through till 2007. And then Dadi Janki, at the age of 92, was asked to come to India to be the head of the organization. What will you be doing when you're 92? Taking on a new job? Unlikely. But here was Dadi Janki taking on a new job. And in usual, she'd been living out of India for 40 years, but came back at that time. She'd come often enough to India, 2-3 times a year, but not actually living here. She'd been living in London. And so this is the story of where we are now, and a lot of expansion into so many countries, guided by the one above, but also the dadis. Dadi Janki travelling to over 100 countries. Age 103, she travelled to the Middle East, Africa, America, Europe and Russia. So the only place she didn't go to was Australia, because they wouldn't give her a visa because she was too old. She wanted to come even then, but they wouldn't give her a visa. So Australia got left out, and South America, she'd been many times before, but not at that point. But 103, travelling, sharing, giving, inspiring, caring. And so the role model of Brahma Baba became the model that all the dadis followed, with a lot of love and accuracy and remembrance of God and sharing knowledge. And their lifestyle of honesty, simplicity, dignity. So, this is where we're at in Mount Abu now, in between lots of other stories. But I'm sure that the centers where you've come from will share with you many other details. And I think it's now time for Toli.